Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Our guest today is Brian McGrath, a retired United States Navy commander who now leads the Ferry Bridge Consultancy. He's one of the nation's leading naval thinkers and advocates who advises both corporate clients and Navy leaders. As we were taping with Brian, however, Navy Secretary Ken Braithwaite was giving a address on the importance of a 500-ship fleet, the notion of a joint strike frigate, and again sounded the alarm on China's rapid naval expansion. So before we get to our conversation with Brian, I'm joined by our producer, Chris Cervello, a retired United States Navy commander and former public affairs officer, who aside from being on our team is one of the co-founders of the ProVision Advisors PR firm, to cross-connect Braithwaite's announcement with Brian's comments. Chris, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Baga.
What was Secretary Braithwaite's message?
I think the biggest takeaway was his full-throated endorsement of the 500-ship plan that Secretary Esper announced over the last couple weeks and was doubled down on by Ambassador O'Brien in his recent visits to shipyards around the country earlier this month. In his address yesterday at the Navy Memorial, he really made the point that he felt like the Navy in particular, during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, took their eye off the ball. Instead of focusing in the Middle East, we need to focus on great power competition, particularly on China. And then, as you mentioned in the introduction, he talked about Chinese naval expansion and the need for a larger, more capable Navy as a way of checking that expansion, and if needed, as a way of not just deterring, but combating the Chinese should deterrence fail.
And one of the other things the Secretary mentioned was this notion of a joint strike frigate, right? Something akin to the joint strike fighter that would allow greater allied interoperability, right? The notion of the F-35, as we're seeing right now with United States Marine Corps and British F-35s aboard HMS Queen Elizabeth, is not just interoperability, it's exact interchangeability because it's seamless given the design of the airplane. The United States Navy is developing a new heavy frigate that Secretary Braithwaite has named the Constellation class. Our sponsor is the prime contractor of that, Fincantieri Marinette Marine. Talk to us a little bit about the Secretary's frigate and how to take them in context.
In selecting the FREM variant that is built by Fincantieri, we kind of do have that. I mean, the Italians use it, the French use it. There is a lot of thought now that the Americans use it, that there may be other countries that would want to either buy the Italian version, the French version, or the new American version. So I think we're well on our way to do that. He also said, when talking about the frigate, that we needed to build more than just the 20 that were initially slated for purchase. You know, that was wrapped into this idea of this battle force 2045. I think it is interesting when you listen to Brian talk in a moment. Brian uses the word fantasy in terms of this idea of growing the fleet to 500 ships. I mean, Brian has been a staunch advocate, not just for naval power, but for naval presence, and has really said that we need to grow the fleet. But he has also warned that in growing the fleet, we can't grow the fleet too quickly and without the ability to maintain whatever size fleet that we have. And you guys talked a little bit about some of the maintenance troubles that we're dealing with now. We have a 300-ship fleet, and Brian talks about the math that goes into not just maintaining the current 300-ish size fleet, but what would it be if we were 355? And then what would happen if we got to 500? And when you start to hear the numbers, it does make you scratch your head a little bit and say, for what? What do we really need a 500-ship Navy for? What are we building it for? And how on earth are we going to pay for it? So I think I would commend the listeners to really pay attention to and really focus on the math that Brian goes through and the case that he lays out.
Before we get to that conversation, how were Secretary Braithwaite's comments received?
I would say with cautious optimism, similarly to how Esper's remarks were received and how O'Brien's remarks were received. I mean, I think that, navalists certainly love the idea of growing the Navy and are certainly pleased to hear the leadership provide full-throated endorsement to growing and both size and capability. But then, you know, after that initial huzzah wears off, it's this like, oh, how are we going to pay for it? What are we going to use the sleep for? So there are a lot of unanswered questions. And so whether it's Secretary Braithwaite, whether it's the next Secretary of the Navy, and you know, probably several secretaries of the Navy to come, they're going to have to answer that question. You know, what are we going to use this Navy for? And how do we pay for whatever size, and how do we maintain whatever size Navy we end up with?
Chris, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Vaga.
And here's our conversation with Brian McGrath. Brian, it's always an honor and pleasure having you on. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Vaga.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Bell, Beretta USA, and Leonardo DRS all sponsored our coverage of AUSA Now, the Association of the United States Army's annual meeting this year conducted virtually. Brian, we haven't talked in a little bit of time, and quite a lot of naval developments have been going on, obviously making headlines with the administration's proposal for a 500-ship Navy, manned, including manned and unmanned platforms. Ambassador Robert O'Brien, the president's national security advisor, wants to fit a prompt global strike capability aboard Burke-class destroyers. You know, the big question obviously is going around how we pay for this ultimately, but give us your sense on what you think of the plan itself. Is this the Navy, is this a blueprint for the Navy we really need, or is the Navy we really need different from this plan?
It's hard for me to consider what Mr. O'Brien laid out in his speech as a realistic approach to things. I am well aware of the desire and the movement to put large energetic strike missiles on the DDG 1000 class, and I applaud that. I think it's a great move forward. I had not been aware that there was really anyone in the Navy or out of the Navy considering backfitting those kinds of missiles into the Arleigh Burke class, not just the Arleigh Burke class, but all three variants of the Arleigh Burke class. And when I think about the expense associated with doing so, and when I think about what it costs you, I don't know what the exact architectural layout would be for such a launching system, but my guess is you're trading six VLS cells or seven VLS cells for each global strike weapon. And so you're dramatically reducing the total number of effectors that you could put at sea if you go ahead and change the launching systems across a large number of ships, like O'Brien is suggesting. I just think it is a plan that has little or no analytical rigor behind it. I think it's fantasy budget-wise. There may be some wisdom in equipping some of those DDGs eventually with conventional prompt strike weapons, but I just don't see it as a rational way forward.
Obviously, Jerry Hendricks and Brian Clark of Telemus and the Hudson Institute respectively joined us to discuss that. And that was along the lines of Brian's argument as well. What did you think of the fleet architecture overall in terms of its composition of vessels, right? So putting aside whether or not you know, those missiles would not fit in the Mark 41 or Mark 57 launchers. At the end of the day, what was your sense on what that future battle force would look like?
Well, I was very pleased with the broad categories of ships that Mr. Esper laid out. And I was very pleased with the sort of general movement of numbers. For instance, more smaller surface combatants, more submarines, fewer large surface combatants. I think architecturally, it makes a lot of sense. I think the numbers are, again, it's just fantasy. It's just absolute fantasy. And the cost of owning that Navy, the Navy that was laid out by Mr. Esper, is tens of billions of dollars a year more every year than the Navy we have now. And I mean, like, seven or eight or nine tens of billions of dollars a year. It's a gigantic investment that I have seen no real consensus around which would produce that kind of money. So I think it's the broad categories I'm very happy about. I like where what he laid out. I just think the numbers are unattainable.
That's the point that a lot of navalists have been making, is we barely have the resources to support the fleet we have, much less build the fleet to that size and be able to support it. The Navy finds itself in a good position where there is bipartisan support for a bigger Navy. There's bipartisan support for a more powerful Air Force. There's even bipartisan support for Army capabilities, if somewhat reduced, right? I mean, there's this sense that the Army, which expanded dramatically with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where the other services had to foot and help in every way they could, had to trim their sails a little bit. Now it's a time for the Army to readjust. How do you think we do this in the most balanced way at the end of the day, right? I mean, how do navalists need to think about how they're making their arguments at the same time that the Air Force is advancing its arguments and the Army is doing its arguments in terms of the kind of well-rounded joint force? And then you've, of course, got the Marines, who under Commandant Berger, trying to make this drive for, hey, look, everything that's not China-related is something that's got to go by the wayside. And here's where I need expanded investment at the end of the day. I mean, how do you think navalists need to be making their argument in an environment like this?
Well, I think the first thing that I'd like to do is to demonstrate how unwise it is to do math in public, for me especially. When I think about the Navy.
Strangely, Brian, I find your mathematical skills remarkably good, but for what it's worth.
We look at the 300-ship Navy, which is where we are right now, as sort of a proxy for the size of the Navy. And by that, I mean the Navy and the Marine Corps, because the Navy force structure reflects a partnership with the Marine Corps to some extent. That Navy, that 300-ship Navy, cost $207 billion, 2019 dollars, $207 billion. And if you want to make it 355, which is the 2016 force structure assessment number, if you just do idiot math, which is what I'm capable of, that's another $40+ billion a year. And if you want to make 500 ships, that's another $100 billion a year. While I think those are very good investments, and while I would love to see the Navy grow and be larger and more powerful and more persuasive, I don't see the great hue and cry for it now. You mentioned bipartisan support. We're in a silly season right now. We are in everything is so hyper political. I don't necessarily trust almost anything I hear right now about. From either side, when it comes to force structure and the like. I just look at the future and I think the following things are going to happen. Number one, we are almost certainly going to continue to do things the way we've done for the last 50 years, which is we will have a strategy that is sufficiently vague to gain consensus among the services and Capitol Hill. There will be no giant increase in defense spending. There will be cuts, if they come, will come proportionally. There will be no great bets placed. There will be no great shifts. And so the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, and the Army are going to have to figure out how to do fewer things less well in fewer places to a lesser degree. That's just reality. I think it's It's the leading edge of the beginning of the decline, the absolute decline of the United States as a military power. I'm troubled by it. I haven't seen the plebiscite that passed this to say that we as a nation are comfortable with it. But I think that's the direction we're going. And until someone makes a very persuasive case for either an across-the-board defense spending increase, which is the way we generally tend to do it, or a targeted increase that follows along some strategy, which most of us wish would happen, but what almost never happens, we will just continue to satisfice in the next administration, no matter who is the topic.
But how much of the blame for that resides? I mean, obviously, much of it does rely ultimately on political leaders, whether in administrations or up on Capitol Hill. But at the end of the day, the services help shape that. And in part, the services have a tendency of not wanting to make the kind of trade-offs ultimately that are necessary. Right. I mean, we have a tendency of doing what we do because that's how we do it, a little bit to your point. And we've burned up massive amounts of resources on things that folks can argue are not entirely as useful as we may have hoped them to be. LCS being an example. We're developing a new class of heavy frigates, in part because those may not be suited for the kind of things we need to do. Or even the original idea of doing LCS, right? It was an experimentation. The whole idea was to learn from it before going ahead and building a big fleet of them. And yet we jumped to that because numbers were very important, right? So how much of this is the services screwing their minds correctly around the problem as opposed to merely politicians who have whims, right? I mean, because at the end of the day, the services pretty much get everything they want.
They get everything they want in if you measure that against what goes over to Capitol Hill as the president's budget. If you measure getting everything you want from the service POM inputs to OSD comptroller, that statement is untrue. At the level of the Secretary of Defense, who has a very difficult job, the services have to, you know, they have to get within the budget controls that OSD comptroller puts out. And so there is internal negotiations within the services. There are trades across the services that happen in endgame at OSD. It is a very difficult process if you are attempting to take care of a joint force that you are loath to make any bold moves to change. You raised the question of whether the bold moves to change should come from the services. That's an interesting proposition. I think services are generally probably less bold than many people would want them to be. And I think, you know, like specifically within the Navy, I'll point at the one that's everybody's favorite is aircraft carriers and the number of aircraft carriers. And there is a sort of blithe and easy breezy opinion out there this is the Navy's just a bunch of druids, knuckle draggers, who can't move past it, and that they are hidebound, and that they deserve everything they get. And the problem with that is that in analysis after analysis, the aircraft carrier continues to prove that it is worthwhile. It's not the only thing that's worthwhile, and there aren't opportunity costs, and there aren't other things that couldn't be done with that money. But it doesn't. It has never fallen to a point where it looks like a patently obvious thing that should be cut. Lots of people think it should be, and you know, everybody thinks it would solve everybody's problem if the Navy cut two or three carriers out of the budget and just built a lot of submarines. I can conjure up a whole slew of really bad things that happen if we unbalanced the fleet in that way. There are no easy answers there are a lot of easy questions, though.
The pushback folks would give you is, I don't think that there's necessarily a push against the carrier as such. It's the Navy's complete resistance to equipping those ships with longer range assets that then cause people to question the utility of the carrier, right? I mean, so it's not that in and of itself it's problematic. It's just that in every single wargaming game, you know, it's sold as the high-end frontline warfighting tool. It is an organizational construct, as you've wisely pointed out. But in high-intensity wargaming, the ships aren't anywhere to be seen because they're vulnerable, right? So they're far away from the action. And that, so really it's, you know, it's not the ship itself. The ship could be more relevant if equipped with the right kind of air power. It's just the Navy has resisted doing that.
I think that's a fair charge. I think the carrier, I mean, and this goes back to Hendricks and my debate at the Naval Academy 5 years ago or wherever that was, where we both, you know, eventually came down on the side that the carrier is not the problem, the air wing is the problem. And I think the air wing has been the problem. And I think that the Navy is putting a lot of intellectual energy towards solving that problem right now. But the problem, the big problem is, the surface guys want a new large surface combatant. The submariners want a new attack submarine to go along with their new ballistic missile submarine. We have to replace the SH-60 fleet, the helicopter fleet. It just goes on and on. The recapitalization of the Navy is a gigantic problem. And when I think about Vice Admiral Kilby at N9 and all of the tough problems that come across his desk every day, I just shake my head and think that that guy has one of the hardest jobs that I know.
I think that this is a challenge for each of the services that are dealing with large legacy programs. I know that you have a degree of optimism to this. I think that it's at least 4 or 5, if not 6 CNOs that have tried to make this case to naval aviation. And it's extraordinary that it's an immovable object. On the maintenance side of the equation, is the Navy, right? I mean, we mentioned that for a lot of people, this isn't as much about more ships as taking better care of the ships we have. Ships are being run hard. There are presence missions around the world. There's a part of the naval intelligentsia that says, hey, we should drop all of those and focus on high-end warfighting, which is a little bit of what we did during the interwar years. Where are we in terms of eating through this maintenance backlog? Because when you go and you talk to people on the waterfront, the vision of a fleet that's being rapidly repaired and rehabilitated is a little bit out of sync from the reality, their reality.
Yeah, because I think the people on the waterfront see it correctly. We're in a really tough, difficult time maintenance-wise. We don't have the industrial base to do what we need to do. We don't have the workforce. We aren't prioritizing it. We are eating readiness. We are ready, eating future readiness in order to buttress current readiness. And the wrinkle of COVID-19 and trying to keep ships from being in port where people can go get sick and spread that sickness and take down readiness, all of those things are conspiring to what I think is a very, very unhealthy trend right now.
Very briefly on JADC2. There's a sense, right? The Navy leadership says we're all for this, but some folks in the Army and the Air Force at the operationalizing level of this feel that that commitment has yet to be reflected in sort of material cooperation at the end of the day. And some folks are asking, how does this work if the Navy is not part of this, right? I mean, obviously the Air Force and the Army have an agreement and they're looking toward the Navy joining them at some point. What's going on and can we do this as a joint force without the Navy participating in it?
We can and we will. I am unaware of what would lead you to believe that the Navy is not participating. I think the CNO has made very clear that being part of JADC2 and being part of this advanced networking is critical to the Navy's future. I think what everyone has to recognize, though, is that there are things in the command and control world that fall solely within the Navy's purview. the combat system on a ship is a Navy decision. Now, it would be an incredibly short-sighted decision if the Navy said, we're going to create a Sony Betamax combat system while the Joint Force is going to the VHS model. I get that. This is, again, one of those things that Vice Admiral Kilby is a big part of, and he's the guy that's helping shape this, is that I think what we'll see is that the Navy will shape its integrated fire control and its own networking, you know, the Project Overmatch, in a way that is consistent with integrating into JADC2. I don't see that they won't do that, but they have problems, real serious problems that JADC2 ain't gonna solve.
For example,
hard kill, soft kill integration on the shipboard level.
Right.
That's one. Ensemble operations, networked combat system operations across a surface action group. That's another. I mean, I could go on for days on this, but JADC2 is something that's going to be a way. JADC2 is going to make 3 and 4 stars really, really happy. JADC2 is not how you fight the tactical battle. That's my concern. The Navy has to work its tactical data oriented architecture in a way that it is easily, it's not just integrated, that it's seamless into JADC2. That's something I think the Navy should be forced into.
Right.
I don't think JADC2 should drive the Navy to choose combat system options at the tactical level, though.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there are some who refer back to Rear Admiral Oscar Meyer's statement at the West Coast Aerospace Forum last year, where he said the Navy will participate in JADC2 as much as its own equities permit. And so there is a little bit of concern folks have that might be a disconnect point. Ultimately, right, because the Navy looks at it as, hey, we did NIFCA and we're doing all of these things that are better than where everybody else is, and sort of kind of that we may be good. But I take your point about getting there and not doing something that damages that tactical ability.
Yeah, the Navy has to proceed with its internal stuff from the perspective of first, do no harm, do nothing that walls you off, do nothing that isolates you from the joint architecture. If they make decisions that go in that direction, they, first of all, they should be countermanded, and secondly, they'd be stupid to do it.
Let me ask you one last question. So what do you think the Navy's priorities need to be, right? No matter what happens a week from now in terms of the election, what do you think the Navy's 2021 priorities need to be?
The network, by far. I realize, you know, I come on your show 1,000 times saying we need a larger Navy. I think we need a larger Navy, there's no question, but I don't see it happening. I just don't see it happening. What I see is I'm back. It's 2014 and Tom Roden and I are inventing distributed lethality again. We're going to have to do a better job of networking the ships, the weapons, the submarines, the aircraft together. This is the whole thing behind Project Overmatch, which is the Navy's portion of JADC2, which will plug up into JADC2. Project Overmatch is the number one thing. I disagree with the CNO. The number one acquisition program or effort should not be this ballistic missile submarine. It should be Project Overmatch. It should be this networking architecture. That's the most important thing.
Rear Admiral Small is now leading the NAVWAR organization that was SPAWAR. Is this the organization that's going to be able to develop that capability? There's a sense that he's going to be a Hyman Rickover-like figure in driving this. Do you get that sense that that's the right seniority, the right authority to help make this a reality?
The Navy has an annoying habit of looking to prophets and saviors because it's worked in the past. I don't like that as an operating model. I think Small is a smart guy and incredibly capable. I think he needs to leave that job out there because that's a big job unto itself. I think he needs to come back to Washington. I think he needs to have the resources, the authority and the support from the CNO. When he talks, it should be CNO. Everybody should know that the CNO is talking through him. I don't know how effective he's going to be able to be from Point Loma out in San Diego.
Brian, always a pleasure having you on. Really appreciate it. And for the rest of our audience, I know that there were a little bit of fireworks between you, the Navalist community, and our good friend Dave Deptula of the Mitchell Institute. And we look forward to having both of you on to discuss that, discuss some of those issues, because there's far more commonality, I think, at the end of the day than disagreement between the two of you. So looking forward to that conversation as well.
Yeah, me too. Deptula is a national treasure, and I look forward to talking to him.
Thanks very much again, Brian.
Got it.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.